No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I am joined by my co-host Kathleen Gomez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affects the lives of all of us. For the past several weeks, we have had guests on the show to talk about issues like equal rights for women and border security. But today, we're going back to the beginning with the issue that started our show in the first place, and that's statehood for the District of Columbia. You know, we've addressed lots of big issues, and so we know we can't resolve all the problems in the world within an hour, so we're going to come back to some of these issues as time goes on, and today we're going to talk about statehood again. But before we go any further, let me introduce my co-host, Kathleen Gomez. Hi, Kathleen. As always, thanks for helping to get the conversation started.
Glad to be here, Senator. How you doing?
Good. I'm doing okay. It's been a good week.
Yeah, it has been a good week. You know, I was real excited about our last show because my kids were kind of teasing me because I kept on going, I'm fired up when we had the show about the ERA amendment, the fact that women are not covered by the Constitution yet. So, you know, our rights are still kind of hanging out there, just waiting, I guess, for some time in the near future for it to be an absolute. So that was a great show, and I'm looking forward to this one, getting back to the issues, which is, you know, statehood for D.C. and the whole issue of how can we have taxation without representation.
Well, you know, I guess that's a problem with a lot of civil rights issues. Just like women, most people think that the people of the District of Columbia have their equal rights already. I remember you saying last week that you thought the ERA had already been passed, and I think a lot of people thought the ERA had already been passed, and they were surprised that it hasn't been. And we find ourselves in the same situation here in the District of Columbia, where people think that we have the same rights that everybody else does, because why wouldn't you think that? It's kind of counterproductive to think that the people of the nation's capital don't have the same rights that you have in Arizona or in New York or in Wyoming or any other place in the United States. A lot of things have been going on with the statehood movement lately. So I wanted to just give a update on a few of the things that have happened lately. As we've said before, there's currently two pieces of legislation in the United States Congress, one in the House and one in the Senate, to make the District of Columbia the 51st state. In the case of the House bill, H.R. 292, we have gotten 33 co-sponsors. And in the Senate bill, Senate 132, we've gotten 7 co-sponsors. So the bills are moving right along. But the big news this week is, first, the Hawaiian Senate passed a concurrent resolution calling for full voting rights for the residents of D.C. This is highly unusual because they did it on their own without any prompting from us. It's significant. You know, it's funny, our guest last week said that Hawaii was the first state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. So it's great that the Hawaiians are at the forefront of the civil rights movement, and we very much thank them for putting this resolution forth and sending it on to the United States Congress and to the president. Secondly, in a special election held 3 weeks ago, the voters of the district overwhelmingly passed a resolution to give D.C. control of its own budget for the first time in more than 200 years. The measure passed with 80% of the vote. Now, there are very few issues in the world that have 80% support, but the idea that we should control our own money here in the District of Columbia passed overwhelmingly, and it's about time. Most people don't even understand that we don't have that power, but we don't, and we still don't have it, even with the resolution passing, because it must go through Congress, and Congress must approve it, or more accurately, leave it alone for us to actually make it a law. But we've taken that first big step. Thirdly, in a statement last week from the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, who said that his children and grandchildren live in the District of Columbia, so he was concerned and believed that there should be two voting senators from the state of D.C. Now, Vice President Biden has always supported the District of Columbia. When he was in Congress, he voted more than once to give the people of the District of Columbia equal rights. So we very much appreciate his input. And last but not least, the United Nations Human Rights Committee at its meeting in October in Geneva, Switzerland, will ask the United States what steps have been taken to ensure residents of Washington, D.C. can exercise their right to elect representatives to the Senate and House of Representatives who are able to vote and fully enfranchise them. And this I find exciting, one, because I'd like to go to Switzerland and testify, and two, and more importantly, I want to know what the United States has to say about this, what their response will be.
Well, it's interesting because I wanted to ask you a couple of questions on the things that you were talking about. First of all, I mean, Hawaii is amazing that they just did this resolution on their own. They just – nobody – I mean, when did they pass this? Recently?
Yeah, they just passed it a couple of weeks ago. And as you well know, because you were in Charlotte with me, we worked together in Charlotte at the Democratic Convention, we put a lot of pressure on the delegations at the convention to, take action. So maybe that got through to a few of the people from Hawaii and they went back and did something about it. But yeah, we had no direct contact with them about it. They came up with it on their own. And all I can tell you is God bless the people of Hawaii. They're very much in the forefront of civil rights. You know, it's funny when Carolyn Cook last week talked about the Equal Rights Amendment and how Hawaiians were the first ones to approve the Equal Rights Amendment to ratify it. I think some people get the civil rights argument and some people just don't.
It just amazes me that they do this on their own. I mean, that's like that. It's just totally cool. And the fact that they also, like we were saying, that they were first to ratify the ERA amendment, which, you know, there's 15 states that have not, and Arizona being one of them. So that was pretty cool. I just find that amazing. And definitely, you know, I used to think it was just an expensive place to go, but I think I'd just like to go to talk to the people and see what makes them tick, because I wish more states, you know, took their following. And then the other thing is, you know, we talk about how D.C. doesn't have the right to vote, but you do have the right to vote for city issues. You just don't have the right to vote. You don't have the ability to vote for a senator and a congressperson to have full privileges in the House to represent your issues, right?
Well, it's worse than that. I mean, that in itself is bad enough. But even our local laws and all the things that we decide on locally have to go through Congress for approval. Now, Congress doesn't actually have to act on them, but they're allowed to act on anything. So if we pass a law, for example, it has to go up there for 35 legislative days. And you know, because you worked on the Hill, a legislative day, that if it happens in the middle of the summer, that could be 3 months that it needs to sit up there before the Congress has met 35 times. And anytime they want to interfere, they can. And in fact, in the 1980s, because they didn't like what was going on in the District of Columbia, they completely suspended our government. They took away the mayor and all the city councilmen's rights to do anything but to decide on city parks. That's the only thing they could do. And they put in a mechanism that they call the control board, which were people that they decided would run the city until the city got to a point where it could run itself again. So basically they declared martial law in the District of Columbia, and they took all our rights away, and they can do that anytime they want to. And they do it.
Didn't you also tell me recently that they, a lot of times they practice on DC, like different initiatives that they would, to see how they work, like, didn't they do something about poor women and having the right to, what was it, to birth control or something like that?
Yeah, they did. They did an issue that was they took away funding for certain types of medical procedures, abortions for poor women, when they're already banned federally. There are no federal funds used for it. But they did it in the District of Columbia because they could. They can't do it anywhere else. If they want to take away state funding from abortions in Arizona, that's beyond their control. They can't do it. That's up to the people of Arizona. But they can do whatever they want in the district. So they did it there because, you know, what happens in the district always gets national attention. And this has really been a problem with gun control laws. Because what happens is, as you know, the District of Columbia has very, very strict gun laws. You lived here.
Right.
But states like Arizona and Alabama have looser gun control laws. So if somebody's running for Congress from a state that already has pretty liberal gun control laws, they attacked the stricter laws in the District of Columbia to curry favor with the National Rifle Association. So they get on the front page as somebody standing up for gun rights, but they do it at the expense of the people of the District of Columbia. And it happens to us all the time. Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's our delegate in Congress, spent, you know, lots and lots of time fighting changes to our gun laws, and finally we lost in the Supreme Court in a decision called Heller.
Well, that amazes me because, you know, you have and I'm you know, kind of like an independent and all that kind of stuff. You know, I'm Democratic leaning probably, but whatever. But as people talk about states' rights and how states need to decide, you know, the future more than the federal government getting involved, I mean, it seems like these guys are doing the exact opposite when it comes to Washington, D.C.
Yeah,
they're
absolutely
getting involved in a local, you know, the local issues and pushing their own agenda when they talk on the other side of their mouth and say, no, you know, localities should have the rule of what they do and state rights and all that. But it just seems amazing how it's always like a double-edged sword, or they say one thing, but they sure act a different way when it comes to D.C.
Well, you know, that's absolutely true. And to tell you how absurd it gets, I was at a hearing one time where they were actually discussing whether we could have a dog park in the Adams Morgan. I point out that it's Adams Morgan because that's where you used to live. But in the Adams Morgan neighborhood, whether they could have a dog park. Now, why does Congress have to consider having a dog park? They also decided whether we have meters in our taxi cabs. We used to have a zone system. Now we have meters because of a senator from Michigan who wanted meters in the cabs. So, yeah, it really gets absurd. And, you know, you and I have talked about the issue of gun control, and we're gonna talk about guns in a few weeks on our show. But you know, where I feel like the people of Arizona have every right to decide what the gun laws of Arizona are, they're different than the gun laws of Washington, D.C., and they should be different. You know, guns serve a different purpose in Arizona than they do in the District of Columbia, and we should have a right to decide on what our gun laws should be, just the same as the people of Arizona or Indiana or Illinois or any other state gets to decide on their gun laws. So that's absolutely true.
Right. And one other thing I kind of am intrigued about is how the new name, if say this statehood goes through, which we hope and it will, you came up with the name of New Columbia, right?
That's right. Yeah, that was decided during a constitutional convention, which is a requirement. We've decided to go use a thing called the Tennessee Plan to become a state, which required us to elect senators and a representative, which is how I got elected. My office was created to be part of the Tennessee Plan. And also as part of that plan, we had to have a constitutional convention, come up with a constitution, ratify it, and send it to Congress. And as part of that constitution, we decided on the name New Columbia.
And how big would D.C. be? Because I guess it borders – you have the water that borders it, you know, with Virginia, right? And then you got right. Maryland. So is there a set amount of land that would be, you know, considered under New Columbia's authority?
Yes. There's the District of Columbia was originally set up by Congress to be 10 miles square. And it was a perfect square. But in 1847, because Virginia was afraid that we were going to outlaw slavery, they used their clout in Congress to take back their portion of the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia was originally created on land that was ceded from the state of Maryland and from the state of Virginia, but Virginia took its portion back. So now it's not quite 10 miles square because we lost Arlington and Alexandria. So what's happened is a map, which was submitted with our request for statehood, was drawn up so that the National Capital Service Area is all the area that the federal government now occupies. It's the mall area. It's the White House. It's the Capitol. It's all the administrative buildings like the Department of Agriculture and the other Department of Commerce and the other cabinet buildings. And everything – I'm sorry, the other government buildings. And everything outside that would become the state of New Columbia and inside the National Capital Service Area would remain the District of Washington, which is the nation's capital. And that's really how we get around the constitutional, you know, our problems all start with the Constitution saying that Congress shall have exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the district. Well, if we carve out a new state, which the Constitution allows, and we leave the District of Columbia or Washington, D.C. as the National Capital Service Area, Congress can still have control over the service area, but the only people that will actually live there are the President of the United States and the First Family.
Oh, okay.
Which is interesting. Maybe this would give them control over Obama. Maybe they should think about it. You know, I'm sure that would be an enticement to them if they wanted to, you know, to have control over the White House. They might not be able to control the president, but they probably could control whether his garbage got picked up or not.
Now, and I know this is probably maybe my ignorance, but now Puerto Rico is they've been fighting for statehood too, in a way, haven't they? Or what? Yeah. Do you know what the situation is with them?
Yes, and it's changed. It's a good question because it's changed dramatically lately. Puerto Rico is actually, believe it or not, Puerto Rico's in a better position and all of the other territories too, American Samoa, Guam, all the other American territories are in a better position than Washington because, first, they don't pay federal income tax, and secondly – they have control over their local affairs, where we don't have control over our local affairs. they have control over their local affairs. So very often we call ourselves third-class citizens because even though they don't have the right to vote and they don't have congressional representation, they do have control over the local affairs. But recently, Puerto Rico had a vote in November where they decided by a majority of 61% that they wanted to pursue statehood. So recently, they have passed the first step to making Puerto Rico the 51st state.
And then that would need the same – what would they need to – from how many states would have to ratify that? Or would it just have to pass both houses in Congress or
that's
be
it.
A state? That's it, huh?
That's it. Pass both houses of Congress in both cases for D.C. and for the – Puerto Rico. You know, a constitutional amendment, as we found out last week, how long has that, the Equal Rights Amendment been out there? It's very, very difficult to pass. But Congress made it easy to become a state. They wanted states in the United States of America when they first started. So it takes a simple majority vote of both houses of Congress and the signature of the president to become a state, just like any other regular legislation. And in fact, the president of the United States has told me personally that he will sign, if we put the statehood bill on his desk, he will sign it. So there's no problem there.
No, but that's amazing. So Puerto Rico does not pay federal income tax.
No, the only federal taxes they pay Social Security taxes, FDIC, but they don't pay any federal income taxes, which is one of the reasons that people in Puerto Rico probably have been, you know, resistant to the idea of statehood.
Yeah, that's not, I mean, that's not a bad benefit if, you know, okay, you don't have a congressman and maybe a senator, but hell, you don't have to pay federal income tax. That's pretty, I don't know, that's pretty good, but you guys do, and you have the highest, one of the highest rates, don't you?
Yeah, we have the highest per capita income taxes. You know, just to be honest, one of the reasons we pay the highest per capita income taxes are because we make the most money per capita in the United States, but we pay the highest per capita federal income taxes in America. And, you know, it's funny, there is a congressman from Texas who has proposed legislation to, he's a Republican, to get rid of the taxes for the District of Columbia. He says, we don't want to make the District of Columbia a state, but they're right. They shouldn't be taxed without representation, so let's take their taxes away. And I think if Washingtonians believe that that could really happen, that there'd be a lot of them in favor of that.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, there is also a lot of people that don't make a lot of money and live in D.C. and have lived there for many generations. But heck, you know, that's not a bad – and it's true. If they're not going to give you the statehood, that would be at least something they should give you guys is a relief from taxation, I would think, you know.
Well, the only problem with that is that it's been proposed many times, even by our own delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, and it's never happened. So I guess, you know, our feeling mostly is that it can't happen. It's not going to happen. So it's a, you know, it's just a way to push us off track. You know, it's like a carrot out there in front of the donkey to get them moving. But yeah, I think there'd be a lot of people and you know me, I live right on the DC line, so that'd be great. not to have to pay taxes. My property value would go way up if I didn't have to pay any federal income taxes.
Can you imagine everyone would be buying homes left and right? And I guess the other thing too is people probably don't understand that Eleanor Norton Holmes, she only has what, like a quarter vote on something, or it's like really nothing. Explain that.
Well, it changes, and this is probably why you're a little confused, because when you were on Capitol Hill, she probably had a vote in committee, but that's a privilege that's extended to her through the Congress. So when the Republicans take control of Congress, they take that vote away from her, and she When they took control of Congress, this time it was the very first act of Congress. The very first thing they did was take her vote away in the Committee of the Whole. She's never had a floor vote, which you understand is, right, is so important. But they've also taken away her ceremonial vote. And it's funny, even when she had the vote, if her vote made the difference in a tie, if she was a tiebreaker, then her vote didn't count.
Oh my God. I mean, that's just, it's just amazing to me because it's so hypocritical. And, you know, I wonder if these, I'm sorry. That whole thing that you just said just sounds so insane. And it sounds like that would be something that would happen in a third world country or one that, you know, you always got when there's a change of power, you know, they bring in the tanks and all that and they do a coup. You would not think the United States of America, which everyone says is like the one true democracy, would do something like that. I mean, how petty and how small.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it is. I mean, I don't think there's a better way to put it, Kathleen, than to say it's insane, because that really is. It flies in the face of democracy. But, of course, as somebody that worked up there for a long time, you understand, you know, they do insane things all the time. Like they exempted themselves from equal work for equal pay. So when they first passed that legislation that – if you had the same job I did and you had the same experience, you had to be paid the same. That right. didn't apply to them.
I know. I remember when I worked on the Hill, I mean, I worked for a Texas congressman and he just passed away. And he was a great guy. Don't get me wrong. But he was an old timer. And, you know, when they were passing all the stuff about sexual harassment, well, they exempted themselves from that, too. So yeah. There was, you know, he always liked to go by and pat you on the butt. But, boy, there was no way for you to say, you know, hey, Congressman, you know, don't do that because I don't appreciate it. You know, I worked for him on the campaign. I used to say, you know, I went to school and I worked for the, you know, wanted to pass women's rights and you're treating me like just like a second class citizen. He would say, look at me. And he would say, well, yeah, it's really nice you went to school and you went to college, but this is the real life, baby, and this is the way we do it. And I'd say, okay, I guess so. So, no, it's true. And I think that gets people very angry that we're expected to follow the rule of the law and they exempt themselves on so many issues. It is pretty hypocritical.
Well, I remember one time when I worked at the DNC and where you and I worked together, and there was an issue over a powerful congressman who we had gotten a call that the architect of the Capitol mm-hmm. was cutting his lawn. And of course, the architect of the Capitol, as you know, right, there's like a zillion of them. The Capitol is just a beautiful place because they have all these guys that take care of it. And their trucks all say architect of the Capitol on them. So somebody noticed that these guys were out cutting his lawn. And we had to call and explain to his staff that that was inappropriate because the government pays those guys, and they didn't understand what we were saying. We had to say it like four or five times. They can't, you know, and finally we said, you need to come up with the $50 to cut the congressman's lawn yourself because the government, and they kept on saying to us, but that's the way we've always done it.
Right.
And it's true. You know, when I first started working at the DNC in 1980, one of the projects that I worked on was a reconciliation of campaign finance money. And in those days, they had just grandfathered in that you couldn't keep your campaign money. But prior to that, you could keep your campaign money for yourself. So imagine what that means if you're somebody that's a very popular incumbent. You raise $3 million to run your campaign, but you really only need $1 million of it because you're popular and you're going to get reelected. You
right.
could keep the other $2 million. I mean, it's just amazing to me that they were allowed to do that. So people really did get rich in those days in going
yeah,
into
did.
Politics.
They did. And yeah. I remember the time where the lobbyists could, you know, could invite the whole staff to go on a trip, which you got paid nothing.
Yes.
You know, when you worked at the Hill, you absolutely got paid nothing. So these little things kind of made up for not making enough money to, you know, make the rent, you know. So it's definitely changed since the days that I was in there, but, you know, probably for the better. And I hope they pay the staff better too, but I don't think they do.
Yeah, back in the days when you and I both worked for Thomas Jefferson,
exactly.
But things have come up. Weren't you? Correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't you with me at some event when some young whippersnapper came up to us and said, "You guys work for Jimmy Carter? My mom loved Jimmy Carter." I wanted to punch that kid.
I remember that really well. It's nothing like – it makes you feel old, too, like when you talk about somebody – or, you know, I think I was talking to somebody about John F. K. and they were like, you know, you would think that everyone would know JFK. But they were like, JFK? Is that the airport? I said, no,
yeah.
It's like the president.
Is that the airport? You know, my all-time greatest was I went to a concert. I hate to digress here, but I went to the concert one time with my wife and the kids. It was Paul McCartney, and the kids in front of us said, "What group did he used to play with?" And we couldn't believe it. And then the other kid, the answer was better. The other kid said, "He used to play with Wings." So on that note, let's turn to some music. We're going to take a short break and play a song that was written by three Washingtonians that had amazing careers at Motown. One was a member of the Temptations, one was with the Four Tops, and one sang with the late great Drifters. I shouldn't say that. They may still be around with the Drifters. So here is Leonard Coleman and Blunt with Stand Up for DC. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Here we go. Stand up for DC, stand up. Stand up for DC, stand up. People of the world, rise up. Stand up for your rights. Stand up for DC, stand up. Stand up for DC, stand up. Come on, DC, get on up. Stand up for your rights.
And we're back. Senator Brown, and I'm Kathleen, and I wanted to mention that Ayanna Gregory, the daughter of the famous comedian and activist Dick Gregory, is featured on the song you just heard, which, by the way, is available on iTunes. So now call in and tell us what you think. We really want to hear from you guys out there. The number is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. We want to know if there's anybody out there on a Sunday afternoon or evening, on if you're on the East Coast, listening to internet radio. So please give us a call and tell us what you think or what you think we should talk about, or just call and say hello and hear your voice. Anyway, so I was thinking, Michael, Senator, because, you know, you are a close friend, and I do need to call you Senator to represent, you know, the status of the office that you do hold, because you run like everybody else runs, like anybody else running for Senate in their state, and it's a hard thing to do, and it's expensive, and it's a lot of work. So, I was thinking, Senator, how could people who may be listening to this, how could they help the cause? Is there like an online petition, or is there something they can call the White House or get their legislators to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. And first of all, since we've known each other for 30 years, you've called me some things that, you know, Michael, it's certainly not the worst thing you've ever called me.
I know, and but, believe me, it's like I'm biting my tongue sometimes.
I know.
You're a good guy.
Yeah, there is something they can do. They can go to www.statehoodnow.org, and they can sign our petition. We have a national petition out that we intend to deliver to Congress and the president. We have about 2,000 signatures. So they can go online and sign our petition for statehood. Or they can also, as you well know, you worked on Capitol Hill, congressmen and senators keep track of comments that constituents call in. So you can call 202 224-3121, which is the Capitol switchboard, and ask for your representative or senator and tell them to support the new Columbia Admission Act, which is the statehood bill. Some, like I say, we have 33 co-sponsors, but that means that we have 402 people who have yet to sponsor. So if you don't know who your congressman or your congresswoman is, who your representative is, you can go on us.house.gov and look up who your representative is and call them and tell them to support the new Columbia Admission Act. And that would be a big help.
And I'm going to repeat the phone number to call in, because maybe if we do that throughout a little bit, we'll get somebody who's listening who says, okay, I'll call in. It's 888-429-5471. You know, it's interesting because when I talk to people, having worked on the Hill for about three different Congress people, two from Texas, one from Colorado, Congresswoman Pat Schroeder, Congressman Maddox, Congressman Coleman, and actually for a little while, Congressman Bryant, it does make a difference when you call in. I know a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, D.C., they don't listen to what we have to say. But let me tell you, when those phone calls come in, they have somebody that takes, you know, answers the phone, and you tell them, look, I either want to talk to the legislative aide who deals with this issue, or I want you to tell the congresswoman or congressman that I want them to sign on to the legislation to make D.C. a state. It is noticed. And the more that you call in, they realize that for every one call, there's at least 10 people that feel that way, but that one person actually made the effort. So they do listen. And it's one thing that I get very frustrated with people, especially out here and, you know, so far away from D.C., they don't think that they can make a difference. And they definitely do. Just like voting, you know, people say, oh, what does it matter? My vote doesn't count. And you and I know, we've sat on, watched the returns on presidential election nights, and you know, and that it does. It makes a huge difference. And not only does it make a difference there, but you're usually voting for your mayor or your county supervisor or your city councilman. And we really are, D.C. is just really a reflection of people and the small town politics. So when we sit there and we say, oh, D.C. is just a terrible, well, all those politicians up there, they're just a reflection of us. They've just, you know, decided to make it a career. But, you know, we got to look at our own town and our own mayors. And when we complain about, you know, the federal government, it really is just a bigger part of the picture of what the local issues are.
Well, absolutely. You know, and we all, I mean, I hear that attitude just like you do all the time. And it amazes me that after an election like Gore and Bush, which was decided by literally a handful of votes in Florida, a national election, or an election like you had in Minnesota where Al Franken was elected, but it took more than a month and several recounts, the election was so close, how people can really believe that their votes don't count. And certainly in local elections, which you and I have both been involved in, we know that that's not that unusual to have things come down to be to have the votes be so close that they need to be recounted and recounted again. So, my opinion, and I'm sure that you feel this way too, is that you really got no right to complain if you're not out there at least voting. And you know, the majority of people in this country still don't vote.
It's amazing. Because, yeah. You know, my ex was from Croatia, and his father spent years in jail writing against Tito. And part of the reason is the Croatians weren't given the right to vote. And they, you know, people in the rest of the world, they die. They literally find that the ability to vote is worth dying for. And if you look at Afghanistan, you know, when the women were walking around, the men with the red dot on their finger, how proud they were. And I go nuts here in the United States when people go, oh, well, you know, it doesn't matter if I vote, so I'm not going to go stand in the polls. And I'm thinking, you know, all those military guys that go out there for our freedom as the right to vote, they risk their lives. And back here, we get so lazy that we say, you know what? I'm not going to vote. Doesn't matter anyway, and I don't want to stand in line. If you stand in line all day, so what? These guys go out every day and risk their lives so that we have that freedom that the rest of the world sometimes will die for or never see in their lifetime. It makes me crazy, and I'm, you know, I get on a soapbox, but I can't understand that thinking. We're kind of a very spoiled nation, and we don't realize what we have. And I've always thought, this is my little idea, that this is remain your citizen, to keep your citizenship, you should travel to a third world country and see what it's like to live in a place that doesn't have all the laws and all, you know, the democracy that we do. And I think it would open a lot of people's eyes.
Well, you know, that's absolutely true. And I remember, I'm sure you and I were raised the same way in this respect. My grandmother, who didn't have the right to vote when she was first born, first came to this country, she voted in every election. She was a matter of individual pride for her. I don't think she cared whether her vote made a difference. I think she just felt like so many, just like you said, so many people had sacrificed so much to give her that right that it was really not her right, but rather her obligation to do it. Exactly. And you know, I think we all feel that way. My kids who are now, I have one that just turned 18, and he's getting registered to vote. And my oldest, who's 20, got not only registered to vote, but got to vote in my election. Now, when she came out of the voting booth, I said to her, "Who did you vote for?" And she said, "Well, that'll cost you $20 to find out." And I said to her, "Well, you know that's illegal. To, you know, what you're suggesting is illegal." And she said to me, "No, it's not. It's illegal to pay somebody to vote, but it's not illegal to charge for the information. So if you want to know, you got to pay me." So, you know, they're not only kids still out there voting, but they're very savvy voters. So
That's right. I guess
we should be thankful for that. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, it's funny in D.C. I don't know how it is in Arizona, but in D.C. we have a motor voter law, which means that you can register to vote when you get your driver's license.
Yes.
And almost everybody does it. But still, we have very low voter turnout. They register to vote, but then they don't show up at the polls.
Yeah, and it's just a shame. And I think that, you know, my father-in-law used to be amazed. He really used to say, you know, "I am so amazed at the United States, because when you have a shift of power and you voted a Democrat out and a Republican in, you guys, they give up power." He says, I can't understand that, because everywhere else, you know, if you would have that kind of change of power, they just bring in the tanks and the soldiers and say, no, we're not going to give it up. But, you know, here that would be inconceivable, I feel, that to ever happen here. And I just think people forget what we're made of and, you know, the Constitution we have, and that we believe in individual rights, yet we believe that we're greater as a whole nation too. So,
Right. And haven't we seen, I mean, again, I'll defer to you on this because you were actually part of this, and we actually have to do a show on this issue at some point, but you were in Manhattan on 9/11 when those planes were flown into those buildings and the Twin Towers. And, you know, people always talk bad about New Yorkers, right?
Yes,
you know,
yes.
They're pushy, they're self-centered, they're blah, 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 blah. But we watched as the nation came together around that. We watched in Boston recently as they came together over the bombings that happened in Boston. You know, it's a shame that it takes that kind of national crisis for us to all stand up and say, yes, we are Americans. Yes, we're proud to be Americans. And yes, we'll pull together. We should do that every election day.
We should. And it's true, because we will have to talk about it, because it was one of those really rare times where we were all we were all so scared yet so strong because we all took out to the streets. Nobody wanted to be in their apartment. Everyone wanted to be out trying to help something, somebody, or just to feel that connection that you know could make us feel okay again. And it happened. So we definitely will have to talk about that. But you know, it's amazing what we do for each other. And I just think we don't stop to realize what a great nation we are, and as a people, what great people we are, and that we're really not against one another, but we really are there for each other.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we certainly need more of that spirit in America, where we stand up for being Americans, regardless of what your position is. You know, those of us that have worked in politics, like you and I think we're used to the controversy. We can stand there and we can listen to people on the other side and not agree with them, but still embrace them, because politics truly is the art of compromise. So, and I think it's harder sometimes for other people to do that. But we do have to do that. We do have to say, look, above everything, we're Americans, and that really counts for something. And we are the greatest nation in the world. With all our bumps and bruises and other things that you could say about this country, it is a light. And those of us that have traveled like you understand that we are a light onto the world because of the great society that we have.
That's true. When I traveled to Croatia after the war and saw how fearful people were after being so many years under the communist authority, you know, I never really understood it until when I was working for Congresswoman Schroeder, we went to Fulda, which is the northernmost point that went into Soviet Union, at the time of the wall, and to see the crosses, you know, on the wall where people had tried to flee. And, you know, there's just so many things that I'm afraid that the youth of today just will never quite get, because everything seems just like, well, that's the way it's always been. No, it hasn't always been that way.
Well, God bless Wikipedia. They make it all seem like it all happened, you know. If it's not on Wikipedia, my kids don't know about it. Exactly. It's a great tool, but sometimes you got to dig a little further. Well, I want to go back to something that you said earlier and talk about next week's show, because it's a very special show. And Kathleen said that there's men and women, brave men and women, who stand up for this country every day and go fight for your right to be heard as an American, and you should exercise that right. And I agree with that. And next week, I'm going to dust off my Harley, put on some Bengay, and ride down to the Vietnam Memorial with 500,000 veterans from all over the country who every Memorial Day ride to the wall in recognition and remembrance of POWs and MIAs, as well as all the brave men and women who have served this country in wars over the years, especially the Vietnam War, but all wars. And I'm going to take a recorder with me, and we're going to interview some of these veterans, and we're going to have them on the show so that you can hear the kind of things that are important to them. There are many issues that involve veterans today. They don't get treated as well as they should, and there's many issues as far as medical care and homelessness and other issues, many of which, you know, I'll toot your horn on this so that you don't have to, but one of Kathleen's main responsibilities when she served on Capitol Hill was working with military families. So you understand the problems that are out there with military families, and we're going to talk about some of those next week.
Yes, exactly. And it's going to be, you know, these guys basically are all about never leaving anyone behind, right, in the war, never leaving a body, or if they're hurt, but definitely not even leaving their bodies behind, always bringing them back with us, right? Yeah.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And they care deeply about it, and it's a commitment they've made. And I got to tell you, it's inspiring to be down there with just tens of thousands of soldiers who made this commitment 30, 40 years ago, and they're still living up to it. They still show up every Memorial Day to remind America that if there's one guy missing, one woman missing, one person in combat that they can't explain, that we need to stand up until we know what happened to each and every soldier, and until we're absolutely sure that every soldier's been accounted for. So it's inspiring to see that kind of commitment.
Well, I was looking on their website, and if anybody listening would like to go and see what it's about, it's run for the wall. Is that correct? Did I say it right?
Yeah, they call it Rolling Thunder.
Okay, Rolling Thunder. But they brought back, I think, recently three soldiers.
Yes.
Who were, I think, in Japan, and I'm not sure. I can't remember the other two because I read it quickly, but there was three of them that they brought back.
Yes.
And I was just amazed that there's still guys out there who gave up their life that, you know, we're trying to find out what happened to them. But they have a great network and they have a great cause and they're very dedicated. So I'm really looking forward to the show too, because I think part of the thing we also have to talk about more is all the great things that regular Americans do for each other. And I think that gets, especially when you listen to the news, where everyone's just calling each other names and being obstinate and just kind of hateful, that is not who we are. And we are people who do so much for each other, and we need to kind of recognize that more.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, this is particularly important to us in D.C. because that's the worst part of not having equal rights, is that soldiers who have bled on the battlefield and then come home to the district get treated like second-class citizens. Well, I see that our time is up. I hope you will join me and my delightful co-host, Kathleen Gomez, next week when we talk about veterans issues and we talk to veterans.
That'd be great. We hope you all come and join us. Please, next time, don't be afraid to call in, and we look forward to seeing you. Thank you, Senator.
Yes, thank you, Kathleen. We got to make sure that phone's not off the hook or something, because we're not getting these people calling in. Well, you know, well, maybe we'll have to pay. We'll have to have a contest or something.
That's it. And we're open to anybody. I mean, we'll handle it. You can be totally against whatever we say, and we still want to hear from you.
That's right. See you next week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right.